All right. Thanks very much. We're moving on to week two on sacred text of Buddhism. And this is going to be quite a bit different from last week. You may recall last week I said we're doing this in kind of a linear time-wise fashion, and everything last week was about the first version of Buddhism, which is Theravada. And what I call this is the revolution, because something changed. That change happened in about 100 B.C., somewhere between 100 B.C. and 100 A.D., of the Common Era, and it involved a new thing that came out in Buddhism.
I'm sorry, what was the year again?
This started between 100 B.C. and then 100 A.D., about a 200-year span. This happened slowly, but it was pretty dramatic once it got going. And it represents something so different that a lot of the things you're going to hear today didn't sound like what I said last week. Almost every major religion has, changes through time as it gets exposed to other cultures and everything else. But this change was much more dramatic than that.
Speak louder.
No, I apologize. I will try to speak louder. This change in Buddhism was much more dramatic than you see in a lot of other religions, and we're going to get into what that actually means. Now, just as a reminder, what we talked about before, we're comparing two things today. We're moving from Theravada Buddhism, which was the Buddhism of Southeast Asia. It was pretty much in place for the first five centuries after the Buddha died. But it's still a major branch today. I want to emphasize that. It's not going away. And it's still flourishing in Southeast Asia. But we're transitioning over to Mahayana, which is predominantly today in East Asia. And all this transition happened, as I said, roughly between 100 and 100, right around the time of Christ. About the same time period. It is now the largest branch of Buddhism and still is flourishing all over East Asia. And by East Asia, we mean China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, that whole area. So we're going to be talking about what this revolution really was and how different it was and the kind of the stresses that happened as a result of it. Now, I'm going to kind of step through this a little first, kind of time-wise, what the evolution was. First of all, I want to emphasize again, Theravada Buddhism did not go away. It continues to flourish today. But what happened was, in about the first century BCE, within India, there was a split that started to happen. It happened slowly, but during that time, there was a lot of concern among both lay Buddhists and even the monks and nuns, the monastics, over Theravada. It was so restrictive that a lot of people were starting to look for something a little more religious, I would say. Theravada held very closely to monastic discipline, very much scholarly work, scholarly attainment, and strict adherence to the original scriptures, which for Theravadas is the Pali Canon we talked about. It's the canon that's still around for Theravada. And with a very strong focus on that, and to a lot of people, this was so aimed at monks and nuns, they felt a little left out. And particularly, if you think of it as India, these people had grown up in the Hindu culture, where this, in Hindu culture, you're surrounded by all kind of rituals and religious things going on constantly. They didn't see this, and it started to become more and more of an issue, even with monks who began to worry about it a little. And so they saw this Theravada as being a little too inflexible and difficult for everyone but the monastics. And as I mentioned last week, the only people who could really obtain enlightenment in this lifetime was a monastic. It involved intense meditation, a great deal of time. So if you were a householder, as they would say, someone who works for a living and doesn't have time to do all this, you can't do it. And you have to wait to some future lifetime when you could be a monk. And so a lot of people felt a little left out who were used to other types of religions. And so they were, I said here, they were longing a little more for a religion of the people. And even the monks recognized that was an issue. And so this started to grow a little. And it gradually led to this emergence of, slowly, of a new form of Buddhism. It's now called Mahayana. The Mahayana stands for, it's a Sanskrit word, it means the greater vehicle. And what it's kind of the analogy they use there is Theravada Buddhism is the lesser vehicle. It's the small raft that carries monastics across to enlightenment. And Mahayana is cruise ship Buddhism. Everybody can pile in. And it's a much bigger vehicle. And at first, even the ones who started liking Mahayana started referring to Theravada as Hinayana, which means the lesser vehicle. And it was a derogatory term. But they don't use that anymore. They respect the Theravada tradition. But this is what emerged out of this. But it takes a little explaining on how this emerged, because it actually is rather complicated. What happened is some new sacred texts started to appear all of a sudden. And it started, again, in about 100 B.C., the first one started to appear, and they kept appearing after this. Now, these texts appeared anonymously, and in fact, they're still anonymous today. No one knows who wrote these texts. But they were offering a different take on Buddhism with a lot of new things to it. And at first, when they appeared, people were kind of surprised by them. But one of the characteristics of these monasteries and so forth in Theravada Buddhism was these texts pretty quickly made it into the monasteries. The monks started reading them and trying to understand them, got confused by a lot of them because they didn't know where they came from in particular.
Did these include things that the Buddha might have said? Or that part of what?
Yes, in fact, all of these texts are further sutras or discourses or sermons of the Buddha. And they all said that. And one of the characteristics of a lot of these sutras, they start out saying, "Thus have I heard," and when they say "thus I means Ananda, which was the Buddha's chief monk. And he said, "Thus I have heard, at such and such date, the Buddha traveled to this village and gave this talk." And then it gives the talk. And these started the same way. So just like the Buddha was just continuing to talk, and which kind of confused people. Who wrote these, and when did it happen? And also, these were not in the Pali language, which was Theravada text. These were in Sanskrit, the ancient religious language of India. And so they were in a different... Although most of these monks were highly educated and could read either one. But basically, well, you know, what are they talking about? They claimed that they were offering much deeper insights into Buddha's teaching. And not only different insights, but new things. And so they were of great interest to people.
When did Buddha die?
In 500 or so, no, 480 B.C. So he was like five centuries before. So that made these things a little suspicious. Okay. And there were a lot of new elements in here that made this into really a fundamentally different religion. And,
what is the Dalai Lama like? Isn't he the Buddha too? Or
no. The Dalai Lama is part of Tibetan Buddhism, which really is a sub-branch of Mahayana. I mean, now a lot of Tibetan Buddhism don't like that. They say, no, we're different. But
don't they, isn't he reincarnated into a child? Or I don't know.
He's the 14th Dalai Lama.
Right.
And they're each identified as a reincarnation when they're children.
Of the Buddha?
Not of the Buddha.
No. Of the
leaders of the Mahayana and Buddhism.
Okay,
and you're gonna hear about a lot of Buddhas before I finish today. But there were new elements in this, these new texts. So let's talk a little about how did people react to this? How did people in the Theravada community react to it? Well, the main reaction at first was simply puzzlement. I mean, they had a number of questions. One of the first ones, of course, was, where did these come from? And who are these people writing these? And they couldn't really figure it out. But one of the things that was very obvious, whoever wrote these were highly educated, so they were suspected to be monks. And because they were very well written and very interesting reading. But the other question then was kind of what we said, how could these be the words of the Buddha? He died 5 centuries ago. And for a long time, these questions didn't have good answers for him. But they continued to be more and more popular because they were seemed to be filling a need that a lot of Buddhists had for wanting something a little different. And so they continued to study these things. And over time, the people who really became advocates of these new texts came up with some explanations. They said this is where they came from. One of them was, these were the secret teachings of the Buddha that he only gave to the most advanced students because he knew everyone else wasn't ready for him yet. It had to be a large body of people who were trained in Buddhism who could then finally understand these. It's kind of like Paul's admonition that we're giving you milk, later we'll give you meat. You know, we're giving you the easy stuff first. Well, this was the same concept. It said, these were the early teachings. So the Buddha taught it to some very advanced monks and asked them to keep it in their head and pass it on to very advanced monks. And then 500 years later, it got written down. And so a lot of the Theravadas said, yeah, right. That didn't go over real well, but some people were accepted. The next explanation was, no, these were teachings that only celestial beings could understand. But they eventually passed these on. These celestial beings passed them on to advanced monks 500 years later and asked them to write them down. Now this actually comes from one of the sutras that's in the Mahayana text, and that tells a story that the first time the Buddha tried to teach this to 500 monks, they all walked out of the room, and because they couldn't understand it, and so he gave the rest of the sermon to an empty room. But the celestial beings heard it and memorized it, and then 500 years later, they passed it down to some advanced monks. Another explanation that a lot of people said, right. But you still see this explanation today in some communities. So these were the kind of things that... But regardless of all these questions, from the Theravada school, which is a very conservative school, these things continued to grow in popularity. And one of the things that... happened over time. This happened to be the time when Buddhists were starting to send missionaries into China. And so as they did this, they were carrying all of these texts with them, not just the Theravada text. And so this is when Mahayana really started to grow. It got into new territory. And as it got into new territory, people first exposed to Buddhism, and they had kind of a choice. Do you like Theravada or Mahayana? Well, there's a lot of attractive things about Mahayana, so it tended to grow much faster as it moved into other territories. But we'll talk about that in just a moment. Now, what is different about this? There's probably about 2,000 things I could list that are different, but I've got just a couple of charts. Some of the differences between the two. And these are kind of very broad, overarching things, but to achieve enlightenment in Theravada was an intense, time-consuming effort to reach enlightenment. Like I said, it was for monks and nuns, and it took most of their lives to do it. And there was so much meditation involved in this that they couldn't have a job or anything. So it was kind of out of bounds for anyone who was not a monk or a nun in their lifetime. But Mahayana started telling people enlightenment can be achieved in a normal life, even if you're not a monk, through a variety of spiritual involvement and religious experiences. Dramatic, dramatic change. And you can imagine this appealed to people who said, you know, human beings tend to be lazy. I like that one over there. It's a lot better. And the ways you could do that are very complex, and we'll mention a couple of them later. In Theravada, the goal was to reach nirvana. And if you remember from last week, nirvana, if you reach nirvana when you die, you never come back and have to go through suffering again. And so you're done. That was not the goal talked about in Mahayana. It was a special goal here in which you can take a vow that when I get enlightened, I will come back into this world system over and over again, maybe for another 1,000 or 2,000 lifetimes, until I help all other beings reach nirvana first before me. And so this is called the Bodhisattva path of Buddhism. And Bodhisattva is another big Sanskrit word. Don't worry about it. But what a Bodhisattva is someone who takes this vow, and they say, I'm not just going to try to save myself, which is somewhat selfish. I'm going to try to save everyone. And so I'm going to work hard, become a Bodhisattva eventually, and then come back again and again and again. And Bodhisattvas are then available to help other people to get enlightened. And so this was a very different concept. And now, Bodhisattvas existed in Theravada Buddhism. They're in the Pali Canon, but they're not people. In the Pali Canon, they're mostly listed. It's a goal. It's a kind of a nice thing to become the ultimate monk, a Bodhisattva who actually comes back. But it wasn't part of their teaching that the people actually did this. Mahayana completely went over that and said, Bodhisattvas are everywhere. They're among us already. And so that was a big change. Theravada, the emphasis was on wisdom, intellectual studying, and not so much on religion and worship. Instead of wisdom, the emphasis in Mahayana was much more on compassion, loving kindness to other people. That was a big change, which was part of Theravada, but not that big. And Theravada centers very heavily on intense meditation. But Mahayana texts, some of these texts, encourages a lot of practice in the world. Still meditation. Meditation is a part of Buddhism everywhere. But other practices that can move you toward enlightenment. And then the last one on this chart, Theravada tended to be a philosophy. I mentioned last week, it's a psychology of the mind and a philosophy almost more than a religion. But in a lot of the Mahayana texts, people started calling on higher beings for help. It was more like a religion. They called on help from other beings, other Buddhas in particular. And so it was filling this need of people saying, I want more like a religion. Now there's some more differences. As more text appeared, more things started being made evident as different. And eventually there was over 100 new sutras, and some of these were very long sutras, so there was a lot of writing that went on. And this became, all of these now became part of what's called the Chinese canon I talked about last week, and that's the canon that is the basis for Mahayana Buddhism. And they're all in that new canon. Theravada Buddhists still today say all those new scriptures are inauthentic. They don't accept them. But they are very big in Mahayana Buddhism. And the Mahayana Buddhists, as I said last week, still honor all the Theravada texts also as being authentic. So it's a little different view. These texts started presenting a lot of new concepts. And I'm just going to hit a few of them, and we're not going to get into detail, but you'll see they're very different. They presented a view that there are multiple Buddhas, actually in the thousands. Some of them are celestial. They don't exist here. And they exist in multiple worlds. There's other worlds with other Buddhas. And this is really very fantastic compared to Theravada Buddhism. And we'll talk about some of these celestial Bodhisattvas and Buddhas when we get into some of the things that actually evolved in Mahayana. But this was a very different concept. Now, in Theravada, there was already a notion that the Buddha that we've been talking about was not the only Buddha. There's actually a list. Like I said, Theravada Buddhism is full of lists. There's a list of the 28 other Buddhas that preceded the current Buddha. So they knew there were others. But now this list is gigantic in Mahayana. Another teaching of Mahayana was that we all have a Buddha nature within ourselves. It's all, it's there, and all you've got to do is get all the other stuff out of the way to reach it. And that was a big, that was a new teaching, and it's an important part of a, of some of the, particularly some of the schools of Mahayana.
Is that the tendency to get a big belly?
No, but the this came up. No, I know. Someone brought this up after class last week and said, well, those pictures I see of that fat Buddha, is that the one we're talking about? And actually, the answer is it probably isn't. Because particularly in Buddhism today, there's so many Buddhas that you don't know which one you're looking at. There may be some fat ones. There's one called the Happy Buddha.
What's the difference between enlightenment and nirvana and the ultimate goal of wisdom?
Okay, good question. The ultimate goal of wisdom in Theravada is to understand reality, understand the way the world really works. Okay, enlightenment is the escape from the continual rebirth, coming back over and over again and suffering. It's the escape. And once you escape from that, you go to a place called nirvana. It's a place. But it... the place is very poorly defined. People have different ideas of where that place is. But it's, the Buddha is believed to have been a man who achieved enlightenment and then went to nirvana, and he's never been heard from since. So the Theravada Buddhists believe the Buddha was a man and he's gone. You can't pray to him, he's gone.
So it's not a verb ever, nirvana.
No, it's a...
It's not a heaven. It is a verb, though.
It's not a heaven in the sense that we think of heaven, but it's something like that. A lot of Christians look at it and say, oh, that's heaven. But a lot of Buddhists said, no, it didn't. It's different. And the point is that it's not well defined. I've seen several different articles about it. And even among Buddhists, they're not sure exactly what nirvana means, except that it's a place of bliss, and you can go there and never come back to the world system. Okay.
Thank you.
In China, Chinese student said to me, Sam, look like a Buddha, speak like a Buddha, but he's talking about Jesus.
Now, another major difference here is the notion that individuals, not monks or nuns, individuals can pursue the advanced bodhisattva path in this lifetime and work on that. And that's the preferred thing to do in Mahayana Buddhism, not just to become a monk and escape, but to become a bodhisattva and come back and help. That's the...
Are there bodhisattvas running around?
Yes.
Are there other bodhisattvas?
There are bodhisattvas in all these versions. There are bodhisattvas that are on this earth, and there are bodhisattvas who are in celestial places available for help, and they're everywhere. There are lists and mentions of thousands of bodhisattvas around. And the Buddha was a bodhisattva multiple times before he finally became a Buddha.
Like guardian angels. Yeah. Ministers.
Are they self-aware, the bodhisattvas?
Yes, they are totally enlightened. But they've agreed to come back and help other people. So they, when they come back, they're moving into a world of suffering, but they're not suffering because they've already achieved enlightenment.
They don't have corporal bodies, or they have corporal bodies.
Yes. So they come back as people because they're reborn as another person. But the bodhisattvas come back as fairly advanced human beings. They don't come back as animals or anything else.
Do they self-identify?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure they do. I think they're probably in secret. Maybe, I don't know. But that's the idea. This last difference is very important, because unlike Theravada, which actually had very few rituals, like I said, it was not that much like a religion. Mahayana, as it moved into other countries, started adapting a lot of the rituals of these other cultures and started adding them to their spiritual life. So Mahayana is has a lot more rituals and religious experiences built into it. And again, people were looking for that. And so that became an important aspect of this. Now, so that's a very broad overview of Mahayana, and that's about all we can do in a very short talk today. But I wanted you to see how different it was. And I'd like to jump right now to what is Mahayana like today? And the important thing to understand is, unlike Theravada, which is really one school, Mahayana is really an umbrella term. And it covers a lot of schools that evolved differently in every culture as it moved into China, Korea, Japan, other places. And so, again, I could present a long list of different Mahayana schools, and they're different from each other. And so this is, again, a case where almost anything you say about what one group does doesn't apply to the others. These are very different, but they have one thing in common, and that is they're all based on the same canon. It's the Chinese canon. They have the same text, but what they do when you're dealing with a canon that's this gigantic, remember we talked about last year, it's like 100 times longer than our Bible. What the various schools have started to do to cope with that is they picked out one or two texts and said, ours is going to be based on these two. Someone else says, no, ours are going to be based on these four. And that's what's happened. And they've split and split and split as they've moved along. I'm going to show you a list of a lot of the prominent Mahayana schools right now. And they're kind of all over the map, but these are important ones. I want to speak a little about Pure Land, a little more detail than the others. Pure Land Buddhism is very popular in China, Japan, Korea, and other places. Pure Land is the religion of Amida Buddha, a different Buddha. And Amida Buddha was a very advanced bodhisattva who came back more and more at a time and eventually became a very advanced Buddha. And he offers, there's three sutras in here called the Pure Land Sutras, just three out of this 100. But if you read those three, it describes the Pure Land. It's a land that he has created somewhere, and it's the land of beauty. It's an ideal place to be. Perfect weather, all the food you want, and a chance to study under Amida Buddha, study under him. And if you study under him, he's going to take you very quickly to enlightenment. And the appeal of this is that he says in these sutras, and he is the speaker in these sutras, he said, here's what you have to do to get to the Pure Land. You have to take a vow, and you have to repeat the vow 10 times, just 10 times. And the vow says, I vow that if I achieve enlightenment, I will come back over and over again to save everyone on the planet. And I'll just keep coming back. But you must take that vow and stick to that vow. If you take that vow and stick to it, then when you die, you're going to end up in the Pure Land. And you're going to get your advanced training.
That's like the 66 virgins.
And so, now, Pure Land, again, Pure Land is not heaven, because you don't stay there. You get your training, and then you get right back into the world system from then on. But this appealed to people, because here's a Buddha that's really going to help me. I can pray to this Buddha and ask for help. And I can get to enlightenment very quickly this way. And I get to see a nice place for a while I'm doing it. So this became a big deal. And Pure Land is a very popular version. It's slightly different in China than it is in Korea and it is in Japan, but it's called Pure Land Buddhism. It's an important one. And the term Amida, A-M-I-D-A, Amida Buddha is the Buddha that they pray to and appeal to. And he's one of the many Buddhas. And a lot of the statues you do see when you travel around in that part of the world are Amida Buddha statues. Okay. As we move across, Chan was a version, as Buddhism showed up in China, it encountered Taoism. And the two kind of came together and picked and added to each other and developed a version called Chan, which, when translated into Japanese, is Zen. So those next two are very similar, because Chan eventually traveled across to Japan, and that became Japanese Zen. It's a strong focus on a very, very focused meditation that gets you moving quickly under a teacher. And it's a different version than other people do, but it's quite popular still. And so you've heard of Zen Buddhism. It's been fairly popular here, even in America, for some people. And then, and Chan is very similar to it. And so those two are on those two locations. Korean Seon is another version that developed. And here, Buddhism came to Korea and encountered some of the shamanism there and combined some of that. But then the Buddhist monks there in Korea decided that there was a lot of foreign bad influences came in with this Buddhism from India and from China, and so they purified it. So they call theirs a purified Buddhism, and it's very popular in Korea. The next three are kind of interesting because they're closer related. I'll talk about the one over there, Tayanta. This is a group of Buddhists who said, and out of all these texts, we're going to take everything from one of them. It's called the Lotus Sutra. And it's a very important sutra. It's very important because when it came to Japan, the royal family actually endorsed it and became a major thing. When it came to Japan, it was called Tendai. And so within Tendai actually had Buddhist priests. And one of the chief priests in there was a man named Nishimon. He's listed here. And he decided that even Tendai didn't go far enough. So he excluded everything but the Lotus Sutra out of what they read and created the Nichiren version of Buddhism. It's still very popular today. And so is Tendai and Tendai. So those three, though, focus on the Lotus Sutra. It's a very important sutra to them, and it's actually a pretty deep teaching. I've tried to read it. It's pretty complicated, but they think it's the summary of all Buddhism, and so they teach off of that. Shingon is one that came to Korea and had a lot of what are called esoteric aspects. They added to meditation things like chanting, mantras, hand gestures, all kind of things that supposedly speed up the process. And these are called the esoteric things. Tibetan Buddhism has a lot of that too. A lot of these mantras and mandalas and other things.
Do you know which branch, for lack of a better word, the
one here on 360?
On 360.
Actually, I don't. I strongly suspect it's Mahayana, but I don't know which version. I don't know. Mahayana is much more prominent in the United States than the others.
Do the common people understand which version they are? Do they?
I don't know. Did you ever know exactly which version you had when you
were? Since I was born, there is a way of the worship. I have to follow whatever my mother.
Probably just do what they're.
Yeah, I don't think. I think probably a lot of lay Buddhists couldn't tell you what I just told you. They've got their own version that their family has practiced, and that's it. So the point I want to leave here, though, is that Mahayana is really an umbrella term. It's a lot of stuff, and we can't get into all of them today. And so we're going to break right here and move into some of the texts. I promised you last week we would read just a few, of the sacred text of Buddhism to get you a feel for what some of these things say. But are there any questions about this overview of Mahayana and what it is? Obviously, you don't know in detail what it is, because I don't either. It's
Mike, do they have a creation narrative?
No. There is no creator God in Buddhism.
So how do they square that with afterlife if there wasn't a higher power that created this world? It seems to me one has to follow the other.
Well, not to them. I covered sort of the metaphysics of Buddhism, which are very similar to the metaphysics of Hinduism. Their view of life is this samsara. You just keep getting born over and over again. And that's, to them, that's a fact. That's a fact of life. And it's a fact they'd like to avoid, but it's a fact.
So these celestial beings... just different, just different realm, different metaphysical realm.
Yeah, many of them are in. They just use the term celestial realms. Not sure where that is.
Okay, so if they come back, are they reincarnate or do they come back as a new person?
They come back and get reborn in a new body. But they're the same person, but again, in Buddhism, that same person is always changing. It's not a permanent self.
But they're building attributes as they come back, or not?
They're building what?
Attributes as they come back.
Oh yeah, in fact, the idea is you're going to progress if you're really serious about it. Every time you come back, you're going to come back a little better. If you do bad things, you might come back as an animal.
Do you come back as a child or as a...
No, as a child. No, you're born into...
Childhood, yeah. And puberty and all that stuff.
Yes.
I'm glad I'm not.
Well, like I said, to both Buddhists and Hindus, samsara, which is the continual, is a bad thing. They're trying to escape from it. That's.
And do you get points for doing good deeds? If I do good deeds, I'll get a point?
Yes.
There's a lot of
meritorious things, and a lot of, even in Theravada, there's a lot of meritorious things you can do to help you in this life and the next life, and there's a long list of them.
Bringing, she never comes to your house without bringing you something.
Yeah.
A little, it may be a loaf of banana bread or anything, just a little bit of something.
Well, and these things you do that for merit are all highly moral things. Buddhism has a lot of very big, strong emphasis on very high morality, because that's what the Buddha taught.
Do you know about that very large parcel
land
out in the way of the Salt Lake?
Yeah. That's Hindu, isn't it? That's Hindu. Yeah. Okay, that's the overview, and I'm hoping you understand a little of that. It's about all we're going to be able to get into in the time. But I did promise you that we would look at a few texts and see what some of these things actually say. And I've picked, this is just my own ones I've picked out, but I'm going to first cover a thing called the Discourse to the Kalamas, which is a very interesting little study of the way the Buddha thought. And I'll tell you more about it when we get to it. Then we're going to cover the Dhammapada, which is probably the most popular Buddhist text of all, in both Mahayana and Theravada. We're going to then go through the Jataka stories, which are also very popular. By the way, all three of these things are things that lay Buddhists read. These are not things that are reserved for monks. These are the popular stuff that most Buddhists do read. And these first three are all from the Theravada, but they're all so popular that Mahayanas read them all too. So this is all Buddhists read these first three. And then I'm going to briefly go to talk about some of the ones that are in Mahayana, which are really deep, and I'll give you an example there. And so I think we've got enough time to get through these. I'm going to first start you on what's a very interesting one called the Discourse to the Kalamas. And this is a very popular one because to Buddhists it represents Buddhist thinking and how you look at things. And it's, I have to set it up first. This was a visit of the Buddha with a bunch of his monks to a little village, and the chief family there was called the Kalama clan. And so they come out of the village as they approach to meet him and welcome him and say, "We're so honored that you've come, we've heard all about you, been reading about you and hearing about you, but we've got problems. We'd like to understand." And so they ask him a question. He said, "We have an important question to ask you." And interestingly, the Buddha's response to that was, "Ask away, because I want people to ask. And it's okay to ask all the questions, even difficult questions." And so, which was kind of interesting, because some religions are a little nervous about people who ask too many questions. But the Buddha said, "Ask away all the time." But then they say, "Okay, here's our question." They said, "Here in our village, we get constantly visited by holy men like you who have got the answer." And one after another says, our version of our religion is the superior one. You can ignore all the others. Believe us." And why should we believe you? And that was the question. Because how do we test it? How do we know it? And so the Buddha said, excellent, outstanding question. And he answered him. And his answer was very brief, and it's going to appear on one screen here. But it's actually a very interesting answer, I think, because of the way he phrased it. And like everything else, the Buddha said, it was a list of things. He said, first of all, do not believe in anything just because it's been reported by someone else, even if it's reported repeatedly. Don't believe it. Do not believe in something because it has been practiced for generations or becomes a tradition or is part of your culture. Don't believe it. Do not believe in something because Scripture says it is so. Well, this is a little shocking to some religions. But he said, even if it's my Scripture, don't believe it. Do not believe in something but believing that a God has inspired it. He said, don't believe it. That's not good enough. Do not believe in something a teacher tells you, even if it's a good teacher like me. Do not believe in something because the authorities say it's so. The government says it's so. Don't do it. Do not believe in any hearsay, rumor, speculative opinion, public opinion, or mere acceptance to logic and inference alone. In other words, don't believe any of this. And this list is kind of amazing. It's kind of every reason some people believe something. And he's, this is it.
But it's telling you not to believe in anything.
Wait. But there's a little space left here. And here's his answer. He said, instead, accept as completely true only that which is praised by the wise and which you test for yourself and know it to be good for yourself and others. In other words, he said, this is experimental. Test it yourself, and if it works, it's the right one. If it doesn't work, find another one. This was Buddha's answer to the question. And so, interestingly, a lot of people have looked at this and said, that's the scientific method. You test it. And
did he go on to say how you would know if it was good for yourself?
Yeah, you have to do it and experience good results from it. He said, if you experience any bad results from this, it's not the right one.
But you yourself would know what's good and bad.
Yeah. And so this has become very fundamental in Buddhism, and that it's a testing thing. It's got to be based on personal experience and personal observation, not what someone else told you.
And positive results.
Yeah, and positive results, yeah. And interestingly, if you read, there's more to the sermon that he gives, but when he came to the end, he said, and by the way, the path that we teach, this Eightfold Path, is aimed at removing all the poisons in your life and everything else. And it's so good that even if you don't believe in an afterlife and you don't care about any of this, it's a great way to live. That was his final. And it's a high, because it's a highly moral life. That was the final part. So this is called the Discourse to the Kalama, and it's very famous within Buddhism. But it gives you an idea of his thought process, and it's fun. And again, it's fundamental. Even in Mahayana, they talk about this discourse as being a very important thought process. That you've got to test it. You must test it.
Could you run through an example?
No. What do you mean by that?
Jesus Christ, that he comes out on top of you.
Well, I mean, what he's saying here is, we've presented you with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. You've got to try it, and trying it might take you a couple of years of trying, but you'll start experiencing good results. And he said, and it leads to the good life, no matter what. But he said, that's the only true test. You've got to try it. And so he's rejected, like I said, his own scriptures, himself as a teacher, everything else. Don't believe any of that. Only believe what you can test for yourself. It's a very interesting.
That's why my grandson, who is as smart as any human being, educated in Europe, educated at the University of Chicago, studied all religions, and is leaning towards this one. It's up here.
Well,
and if I Yeah, and he has a Buddhist symbol here tattooed. And we had lunch. I said, "What is that, Peter? You never told me what that is." He said, "That's a Buddhist symbol for health, happiness, and prosperity, I guess." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Oh," I said, "how's that working for you?"
Well, Dave, has your son ever commented on why he chose Buddhism?
I think he actually went through a set of things like that.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I, one day in high school, we said, "What if there is no God?" And that was kind of a start of a deep thought process that lasted through college. And these all, I think, are consistent with the way he would think.
Mm-hmm. Well, there, you know, a lot of people have written about the fact that this kind of thinking in Buddhism has a certain appeal to the modern mind of highly educated people, that they kind of think, "I can make my own decisions."
Right.
Have you ever read about, there's theories that Christ, those years where he was missing, was studying with these people?
Yes.
Over.
Yeah,
so, I mean, that doesn't seem, because he is the living, you know, he is all those.
Mm-hmm.
Looks up in the scripture.
Well, but in China, I think Dr. Farachan-san was talking about C.S. Lewis.
Uh-huh.
And then they are talking at the end, we have to think another person first. But Oriental people cannot understand the meaning of the, how we think another person first. So they asked me how I think about that. So I have to be honest to them, at least. And then I said that if we don't love us first, if I don't love me first, how I know how to love another person?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so the way they think, that you look, when you see this, you think I. Mm-hmm. But Oriental people think I. But basically, they think another person without any imagination, they think about another person, and then they show their love and affection to another person, comparing another people. But expression we discuss in our own language, we always say I. In English, you say you. So it's a little, you know, we have the same love, affection, but the expression is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I over you. So, I was raised like this. My grandmother always combed my hair. He was talking from the first one and last one every time he was talking to me. And I was 5 years old. I don't understand. But I just remember what she said.
Yeah.
But she sounds like I have to think about myself. But the message was no, I have to think another person first.
Yeah.
So, explanation is a little different,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, Jeff would say that others is a very important part of that last line. It's not just good for yourself, but also good for others.
Yeah.
And one of his essential beliefs is that no individual is any more important than any other individual anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so an important part of achieving enlightenment is to recognize that we all have equal value, and it's important to care about everybody to an equal degree.
Okay, good. Well, the discourse was quite interesting. This is something completely different. It's called the Dhammapada, and it's generally listed as the most popular Buddhist text of all. It's the first one that was ever translated into English. And what it is, it's kind of interesting. It's a summary in very short verses of all the wisdom spoken by the Buddha during his ministry. So some monks have gathered this together, and it's just a list of wisdom sayings, one after another.
Proverbs.
Now, I was going to say, I'm going to put that up here. It's believed to be the most widely read scripture of all, and it's in the Theravada canon, but again, all Buddhists read this. And it was the first one translated into English, and the closest analogy would be our Book of Proverbs. It's just a list of good ways to live, is what it is. And so it's very popular. It's quotable. People like to quote out of it. And it contains 423 verses, so it's not very long. You can read it in probably an hour. And it's divided into 26 chapters. And just looking at the chapter titles, you can see it's tends to be very practical things. Here's some of the, just a few of the chapter titles. Thought, the fool, the wise man, evil, old age, the self. And it's just, in each case, they gather all the sayings that the Buddha has that covered happiness, covered pleasure, and so forth. I'm going to just show you one chart of one slide of some of the verses. This first one actually sounds very familiar. I've seen it in other places. All we are is the result of what we have thought. It's founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows him as the wheel follows the foot of the ox that draws the carriage. Mm-hmm. So the Greek Stoics had this exact same kind of thing. Thinking is the problem. For hatred does not cease by hatred at any time. Hatred ceases only by love. This is an eternal rule. And I just arbitrarily picked these out of the Dhammapada. They don't follow any pattern. Bad deeds and deeds hurtful to ourselves are easy to do. What is beneficial and good, that's difficult to do. Though all of his life a fool associates with a wise man, he no more comprehends the truth than a spoon tastes the flavor of the soup. Do not associate with evil companions. Do not seek the fellowship of the vile. Associate with good friends. Seek the fellowship of noble men. There's a lot of, like I say, these are very quotable. People like them. I've seen them in the bottom of emails sometimes. So that's the Dhammapada, and it's you can download it off the internet. It's easy to read. You might be interested in it. The Jataka stories are very. I was not very well aware of this until I started the study. These are events from the previous lives experienced by the Buddha when he was in his last intense meditative state. Right before he became enlightened, he was exposed to all of his previous lives, and he remembered all that. So then he used that as he traveled around and gave his various sermons, and he used it to illustrate moral points. He was always making moral points with these Jataka stories. These are very popular among lay Buddhists, and it's a good way of teaching children because these Jataka stories are real short, and they involve animals all the time. They're kind of fun.
Aesop's Fables?
It's very close to Aesop's Fables. In fact, one of the Jataka stories I read sounds just like the goose that laid the golden egg, just like it, out of Aesop. And so I think they may have been a little comparing notes here among the ancient Greeks. Yeah, but these are very popular among lay Buddhists as a way to learn the moral life and to teach children the moral life. There are 547 Jataka stories. He had a lot of lives. It's just the ones he remembered, I guess. These are also, again, read by both forms of Buddhism. And the way they're used is interesting. Artistic representations of a lot of these stories are found in temple decorations. They're Jataka coloring books and animated cartoons for children. It's a way of learning things. And all these ones in the temples are used sort of like the Middle Age cathedrals in Europe had all these stained glass pictures of Bible stories, and the priest would bring all these illiterate people in and show them the thing and tell them the story. Well, the Buddhists use this in the same way. They use these things to teach children.
So this was once in the temple in Damascus, Europa, that's what it was called. It was an old Jewish temple that had been uncovered after, and on the walls were the original drawings of all the Bible stories. You can see Moses across the Red Sea. It must be universal.
Yeah, universal way of teaching people who can't read. Yeah. Because most people couldn't read. And so you show them a picture and then tell them the story. Okay, I'm going to give one quick Jataka story because we're almost running out of time. It's kind of a cute one. Kind of an interesting one, I should say. There was once a rabbit who, encountering a group of extremely hungry humans, taught his friends, the otter, the jackal, and the monkey, the importance of sharing their food with those in need. They did, but when the rabbit discovered that his food, which was bitter grass, could not be eaten by humans, he threw himself into the fire to provide them with fresh cooked meat. The ultimate sacrifice. And then that's followed up by, the gods were so impressed with this extreme example of self-sacrifice for those in need, they honored the rabbit by putting an image of the rabbit on the full moon so that every month everyone could look up and see the rabbit. Now, when I go out, I see a man in the moon. But from this story I read, most Buddhists look up and see the rabbit. Now, I've tried the last 2 months to find the rabbit. I can't find it. Now, so there's, like I said, there's a lot of these stories, but they're teaching tools within Buddhism. Okay, we'll get into deep philosophy. We're going to jump to Mahayana and just give you one of the things that happened in Mahayana is a real dive into non-duality philosophy, very deep. And the first important sutras were the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, and they represent very distinct teachings that were not in Theravada, but they also were again deep philosophy of how the world works. And it's actually a very sophisticated and difficult understanding to understand philosophy of non-duality. And the initial ones were very long. One of them was 100,000 verses or something like that. But later their teachings were condensed into versions that were the size of a pamphlet. That's called the Diamond Sutra, a very popular sutra. And there's even a one-page one called the Heart Sutra, which summarizes all of this. But just to give you, I'm going to just put a small sample here for the last slide out of the Diamond Sutra. And this is the Buddha speaking to a disciple and explaining to him why his understanding of the world is actually completely wrong. And if he understood it correctly, enlightenment is trivial. And so he says, he's speaking to a disciple, and he says, where there is emptiness, there is neither form, nor feeling, nor perception, nor impulse, nor consciousness. Now, let's stop right there. Those four things, remember I talked last week about the five aggregates that make up your soul. It's form, your body, feeling, your senses, perception, how you deal with those senses, impulse, and consciousness. And so right off, he's telling this guy, none of those things actually exist. You just think they do. He says there's no eye, there's no nose, no tongue, body, mind, form, sound, smell, taste, touching, objects of mind, no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death. So none of these things are real. And finally, this is the real coup d'etat for him. He says he destroys the Four Noble Truths. He said there is no suffering. There's no origination of suffering, which is desire. There's no stopping of suffering, which is the Third Noble Truth. Nor is there a path, the Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. There is no cognition, no attainment, no non-attainment. And he goes on to say in this thing, if you really understood this, enlightenment is trivial. Because once you understand there's no such thing as suffering, you're enlightened. And so, but we couldn't teach you that at first. That's just too deep. So, but these teachings are in Mahayana, these deep philosophical things. Usually only the monks read this stuff, but they're there.
That's what's left.
Well, and basically in Buddhism, there's nothing left. It's, in fact, it's Buddhist doctrine that Buddhism itself is going to go away too, and there is no Buddha. That's doctrine. But don't ask me to explain that.
But that's saying that everywhere there's nothing. There is nothing but emptiness. There is no nothing.
One of the schools of Mahayana Buddhism is called the Emptiness School, and that's what they focus on.
Good name.
Okay, any other questions? So that's what you can cover in 2 weeks.
I have one comment. In China, they ask Buddhist people what is the difference between Christianity and Buddhism? Mm-hmm. And we, you know, Andy Dierman gave his version, and Doug Fletcher, and Dr. Doty, and so on, And then it came to Coco's turn. She said, it's very simple. Jesus is alive, Buddha is dead.
You know, I wanted to finish this meeting.
I think you ended it. Other questions? Okay, I think I need to release the class. We're getting a little late, but thank you very much.